session number 23435 Reel 2.
I'm Lindo, Reel 2. What sort of routes did you have during your training?
Well, I don't know whether most of the North Wales is really a very beautiful country, and there were obviously set routes. If you went out in the morning, you went up one route, and if you went out in the afternoon, you went out another. And there was always little cafes where we stopped for lenses or tea or something, but it was all fairly kind of mountainous, except when we went to the coast to Barmouth, where we went in convoy, which was very exciting, and that was sort of along the main roads. But it was basically quite narrow roads, because that part of North Wales is not very, nowadays probably has motorways, but then it didn't.
And what sort of things were in the town? Did you have a cinema?
Well, in Pateli, there was, I think they rather resented us, because we rather took over the town. There was a big naval station just up the road, and they had a nasty habit of talking in Welsh if you walked into the shop. I think there was a small cinema, but not very good. And the shops had odd bits. Occasionally you found something you couldn't get anywhere else, or like bath plugs, because no Air Force wash bases ever had bath plugs. So if you found a bath plug in a shop, you bought it. And a water bottle, I think I bought, because I thought the winter's coming on. But they were like little seaside town shops, really. In those days, there wasn't much trade for them, which was a shame in a way.
How did you get on if you want to buy feminine items?
Well, if we're talking feminine items, the Air Force issued those. You used to get them free from the Air Force. You just went to the stores and asked for them. They were very good. They provided everything, really.
Stockings as well?
Yes, stockings, sanitary towels, everything they gave. The only thing you had to buy was things like talc powder, and all, if you could get any, the soap and stuff. But all the rest they issued, and they were very good at it. They didn't just bother; they just dished them out.
What did you do in your spare time?
Well, when at there were the four of us, because there was Daphne and Doris and Tweedy and myself, and we used to had to walk into town. Unfortunately, we didn't have a naffy there, because it was just a sort of the hotel, so that was a shame. But I did play quite a lot of hockey, actually, because I like hockey. And there was a naval station, we used to go and play them. But there wasn't a tremendous lot to do, and we were slogging away trying to learn all things about engines and sides and things,
So this is all quite new to you. Did you really feel very interested in it?
Yes, I think I did. I was quite determined I was going to pass, I think. This was a thing, and I was prepared to put up with most things. And it's amazing how, I think, when you're young, you take it for granted that this is what happens. If you're going to have discipline, you've got to obey it, Whether you do later on is another thing.
Did you have to know how to deal with the engines if you broke down?
Oh, yes, we had to know how to clean the engines, how to change the sparking plugs, how to change the wheels, and if necessarily mend a puncture in the street, all that sort of thing. We had to learn all that. And we had to draw pictures of them when they asked us things, which was a bit tricky. But it's really maintenance of a car, rather like a mechanic does, but not quite so thorough, I think.
So when you had tests, you had theory tests as
well? Oh, yes, quite a strict one, too.
What was the procedure during blackout driving?
Well, we had those funny little slits on the headlights, which were then everybody had, so you couldn't see anything. Each headlight had this sort of black covering, and with slits of about a centimetre wide. There were three of them, I think, sort of in little lines. But the only thing was, of course, there wasn't much traffic about. And you just had to hope you could see, because there's no street light and there were no cat's eyes on the roads, It was just sort of creeping along.
It must have been quite scary.
It was just scary. I think it was... Well, one never got scared. I think it was just that there was so little about, because there weren't very many civilians driving at night, really, unless they were on duty doing something.
So you wouldn't have encountered much of other traffic coming up?
No, very little, really, I think, on the whole, all the time. I mean, army stuff, probably, and they were having the same troubles we were, so...
Where else did you go?
Well, after we'd had done our course, which was 6 weeks, so about, the, I think it was the, I don't know, second week of December, I think, we were all biting our nails to see if we'd passed out into it to be MT drivers. And when the notice went up, thank goodness I did, so I was then a fully fledged MT driver, the lowest grade of person in the Air Force, I think, but still. And we were given a list of where we would be posted. I'd actually asked to be posted to London, so I could be near my aunt, and was posted to Gloucestershire, to Innsworth, which is just outside Gloucester, which was sort of a mixture, really. It was also another WAF recruitment area, and it also had a school for flight mechanics and that sort of thing, so that it was a bit of a mixed bag. But another girl and I, called Pam Thomas, were posted to Innsworth, which, lucky for her, because she only lived in Bristol. Anyway, I think we arrived down there just before Christmas, about the 17th of December or something, after another long and dreary journey. We were picked up at the station at 1 a.m. and taken to the place. And we turned up, and we were some of the first WAF drivers on the station. There were three others, I think, who'd arrived 3 days before. So having got ourselves sorted with beds and stuff, we were told to report to the MT section, which was looked after by a very nice RAF sergeant, and all the other drivers were men. And you could see they were jolly suspicious of a whole lot of girls coming in to do their job. So, and they set about trying to trick us into things, I think, really, and they to put you through an induction course. And, I mean, they did all sorts of silly things like pretty stuffing up things up the exhaust pipe and that. And one of their favourite ones was to tell us to mend a puncture on the little crane. So we may have been new, but we weren't that stupid, because the crane had solid tyres. So that, and anyway, after eventually, there was no rough stuff. They decided that we weren't so bad, and we weren't going to pinch their jobs, because they still drove the lorries and we drove the cars, really. Except that I seemed to have got landed with all sorts of strange vehicles. First I drove the fire engine, which was a sort of open-backed lorry with a sort of pump on the back and a bell, and he used to charge around the camp ringing this bell on fire practice. And the trouble was, if you went too fast, the pump on the back lifted the front wheels in the air, but it was quite fun going around there. And then I drove the ambulance for a bit, and then I drove this strange crane, which was used for lifting engines in and out of aircraft to teach the RAF fitters what to do. And that was quite tricky, because you steered it. The back wheels actually did the steering. I mean, the front wheels didn't do anything to go forwards, and the back wheels steered it, so that you charged along about 3 miles an hour, I think. But it was quite fun, and you got quite good at lowering engines into aircraft. But funny part, actually, one of the times I was going around in the fire engine, there were a whole load of WAF recruits walking along, and in the front of one of the columns was a great friend of mine from Portugal who I'd grown up with. So I clanged the bell, much to the horror of her sergeant, I think. But we weren't able to meet up properly, as she was going off to her course the next day, I think.
You had said goodbye to your two close friends, hadn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, when we left Pacelli, they were posted, I think, to East Anglia, but I've never heard or saw them again, which is a pity. I often wonder what happened to them. I'd mentioned before that Pam lived in Bristol, and as it was Christmas, we were given Christmas Day off, so we decided we'd try and get down to her house. The only way to do it was to hitchhike. So we left the camp at about, it's still dark anyway, armed with a torch and a white handkerchief, and off we set down the road. We were first of all picked up by a beer wagon, which was pretty smelly, but it sounded rather like a huge hangover in the early morning, but anyway, he was kind, he took us quite a long way. Then the next one we had was the post office van, who took us really quite a long way, and we had a good ride with him. And we'd just been dumped when a chauffeur-driven car pulled up, and a lovely old man leant out of the window and said, would we like a lift? So we, of course, said yes. So we were put into this beautiful car and driven all the way to Bristol, which was wonderful. And when we got out, he gave us 10 shillings each and said, have a happy Christmas, which to us was a fortune, as our pay at that time was £1.2 and 6 a fortnight, which didn't really go very far. We had a lovely, well, we just walked into Pam, we arrived for breakfast at 9:15, which wasn't bad, really, and her mother gave us a large breakfast, and we spent a lazy time sort of chatting, and she hadn't seen her parents for a few weeks. And then her father took us to the Grand Hotel, where we had a drink, so we really felt very civilised. We had a lovely lunch, and Mr. Thomas kindly drove us back to Camp at Gloucester, which was lovely. And it was really my first Christmas away from home, and one of five which I spent in the Air Force.
Did you have a birthday around this time?
Well, my birthday's in December, yes. And my parents had sent a cheque to my aunt, and it all, eventually I got some money. So I went, I bought myself a portable radio and a bicycle that I thought possibly might be useful, as we couldn't afford bus fares. I don't really like cycling very much, but it seemed a way to get around. And one weekend I decided I'd go to Evesham and see some friends who, from Portugal, who were working in the Brazilian section of the BBC. I must say, I don't think I'm ever going to cycle again. It was awful. But we spent a happy weekend trying to make an omelette out of powdered egg, which ended up as scrambled eggs, and we talked and talked. But I did get able to put the bicycle on the back of a lorry coming home, so that wasn't so bad. But at this time, I got a letter, actually, from the Portuguese section of the BBC, asking me if I'd like to do a broadcast about life in the Air Force. So I went and asked the CEO if I could go up to London to do it, and they said yes. So they gave me a railway warrant, off I went. And I met the people, I went and did this broadcast. Actually, it was a sort of an interview, and all on a script, so you couldn't really go wrong. I was a bit shattered how much Portuguese I'd forgotten, but we got through that. And then they suggested I should do In Town Tonight at the BBC while I was there. So I was trundled off to BBC itself and had an interview with John Ellison, who used to do it. And in actual fact, it never did get broadcast. I suppose there were other people in town that night, not me. But it was all quite fun. It gave me a couple of days off, which was nice.
Were you paid?
Oh, yes, I was paid something like 10 shillings or something, but I got all my travel expenses, so that wasn't too bad. Seemed quite a lot of money, you know, in those days.
How did you get by with the money that you were given, that you earned?
Well, I mean, all the food was given to us, and we also got cigarettes on ration. And if you smoked and didn't eat sweets, you swapped and things. And my father also occasionally gave me some money, so it was, you just about managed to pay for naffy tea and stuff, and the cinema was very cheap too, so we all got by, really. By the time you got to the end of the fortnight, you didn't have anything left, and you probably owed somebody 15 cigarettes or something.
What did you do when you, on your leave?
Well, leave was sort of, we were supposed to get leave about every 3 months. It didn't always work out that way, but I used to go back to Virginia Water and really sort of, nowadays they say chill out, I think. You know, you just got out of uniform as quickly as you could. I had been given some clothing coupons from the Ministry of whoever for my lost stuff, but of course it didn't do much for in the way of buying clothing. But I did have a few civilian clothes. And I used to help my aunt with the vegetables and stuff. It all went very quickly. We never got much more than about a week to start with, and eventually we got three 2 weeks, but that was usually about a week.
That would have been in the spring, where you joined your aunt and uncle once again?
Yes, I think my first leave was in the spring. And then I got back to Gloucester and found I'd been posted to a bomber station in Lincolnshire. And so I thought, this must be good, you're going to a proper Air Force station now. So another girl called Iris, who was in the MT, and I set off to go to Lincoln, which seemed to be miles away, and it took us forever. But I put the bicycle on the train, and we arrived in Lincoln at some an awful hour. And lo and behold, the bicycle was there, and we were picked up and taken to this bomber station called Hemswell, which was just south of Lincoln. And it was huge. It was a peacetime station. So all the buildings were brick, most of them, and they had married quarters and stuff, which now had weren't occupied by wives and stuff. And they built a lot of wooden huts. And we thought this was going to be nice. There was a cinema and a gym and all sorts. So we started unpacking and getting ready. When we were then informed we were going to be sent to the satellite station, which was about 2 miles up the road. A satellite station is a sort of an overflow of a big station. And this one happened to be a Polish one. So off we went to this place, which was absolutely, I don't know how to describe it quite, actually the end of the world. It was a huge field, which was the airstrip, and then there was, the whole thing covered a lot of fields, but the WAF accommodation was one hut. There was no running water. No hot running water. We had to heat up the water on the stove in the middle of the room. It was really terribly, terribly basic. And the whole thing, I should think, was a sea of mud in the winter. It wasn't too bad, but it was all so far away. We had to, and luckily I had my bicycle, but everybody else had to have Air Force bicycles, which weighed a ton. But it was the first time we'd seen aeroplanes close to, and they were Wellington bombers, which were in those days called Wimpies. And so it was just really quite an exciting time.
Did you get to know any of the bomber crews?
Well, not really. I mean, because it was such a sort of spread out place, you know. There was no NAFI that you could go to or anything, and we used to be taken back to the main camp twice a week for baths and washing and ironing and stuff. So we never did really get to meet anybody much, which was a great shame. But, I mean, we did have night duties when the bombers went out. And if you were on night duty, you went on duty just sort of about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the first thing you did was to go up to the MT hut, which was on the edge of the airfield, and go and collect the supper for the people on duty, which was a huge hay box with food in it in sort of containers. And then you did various duties. You had to take the ground crews out to the aircraft to do checks, and then you took out the crews to the things, and they all went off. And just before they took off, you had to go up the runway with an airman putting out the flare path, because in those days, this one particularly hadn't got laid on flare path. It was lamps, so you had to go slowly up the runway while he put out these lamps so they could take off, which they duly did. And then we had to rush down and pick them all up again, so that in case there were bombers, German bombers or things lurking around, it could see them.
So they were kerosene lanterns, were they?
To start off, they were, yes. And eventually we decided that it was stupid lighting each one, so we took them all out lit in the back of the lorry, which wasn't allowed, but it was much quicker.
Did you drive the crews out?
Yes, but sometimes we drove out the crews, because they in Wellington they had, I think it was 6 crews, so you sort of took out 2 or 3 crews together and then dropped them off at their aircraft.
I've got written here the control caravan.
Yes, well, on the in the middle of the runway was a sort of caravan which where the controller stood, who it has a sort of glass dome on it, and he looks out and signals to the aircraft when they can take off or when they're coming in. And so as soon as the first aircraft start taking off, he then stands up and signals them with a sort of lantern thing that they can take off in whatever order they're going. And then we used to then go and collect the flare path in, and then you had to wait until they came back again, which was sometimes a bit worrying, you know.
How did you fit in meals and sleeping?
Well, during that time, after we'd sort of seen the aircraft off, which was usually sort of early evening, I suppose, about six, when as soon as it got dark, really, we would then have our supper in the MT hut. And then there were a couple of beds there, and you used to sort of take it in turns to lie down, and actually we did sleep a bit, not a lot. And then, of course, the next thing was when they were due back, we were told that they were to get prepared to put out the flare path again, which we then, as soon as we were told, we went up again, putting it all out so that they came back. And then, of course, you have this awful wait of seeing who's going to come back and how many are going to come back. And at one point, we had all come back except one. No, two, I think it was. And we heard that one had landed in another aerodrome. But then we had this one coming back, and we'd heard that he'd radioed in that he had only one engine, and Wellington only has two anyway, so that it was a bit vital to get him down. And I think probably he also said, I think he had engine on board, so we all, ambulances went out ready and the fire engine went out ready. We heard this rather awful noise of the airplane struggling to come in, and eventually and he couldn't get his wheels down either, so he sort of landed on the grass quite well, really. But, of course, the thing slewed down right in the middle of the runway, so that stopped anything else coming in. But we did hear, as I say, that the other airplane had landed at another place, so all was well. But they were very lucky they landed sort of on the grassy bit.
During that particular experience, what did you drive?
I was driving one of the crew lorries, which was one of the, what they call the 30-100 weight lorries.
Did you get to know any of the pilots personally, did you?
Not really, no, because you see, it was such a spread out camp. I mean, they went off to the officer's mess or the sergeant's mess, and we just went back to our place. It wasn't a place really where you could get to know people very well, except the ones you worked with. It was a shame, really, but I wasn't there very long, so.
How long were you there?
I was only there 6 weeks, I think. It was ridiculous. I mean, I went on leave having, I think it's about, after being there about a month, I think I was due to go on leave. And while I was on leave, I had a thing saying I'd been posted to Bristol. It really was a bit stupid to go all the way back to Bristol again, but as it turned out, it was a very good idea.
Were you ever taken on any test flights?
I went on one with the mechanics, which is, it's amazing really, because you see sort of everything from above, and the thing that I always remember stood out so much was things like bunkers in golf courses, because of all the green, and then you suddenly have this bits of sand sticking out, and of course all around Lincoln is very flat anyway, so that it was amazing the things that did stick out. You could see quite well. We weren't very high anyhow.
So where did you go from there?
Well, from there I went, was posted back to Bristol to, it was 927 Squadron, was a balloon squadron. And the squadron headquarters was in a house on the top of Bristol Downs, which was lovely, really. And then we lived in a commandeered house just round the corner. It was quite a small station because there were, I think, a lot of sites all around Bristol, which were called sites, and then there were the flights, and we were the squadron headquarters, so that I think the whole of Bristol from the docks to all round was all spread out with balloons. But it was just nice, though, when there were only about, I suppose, six drivers altogether. It was a very nice place to be, and of course Bristol was a very good place to be stationed, because there was a lot to do, and concert halls and cinemas and pubs and stuff.
What was your accommodation like then?
Well, we had this house they'd taken over, and the whole, I think, of the WAFs, there were only about 20 WAFs altogether, and we slept about three in a room. It was really very civilised, with bathrooms and things, and we still had the inevitable Air Force beds and the biscuits, but it was all right. And then the mess hall was another house, and then the headquarters, the mess hall was a Nissen hut in the, it used to be the old tennis court in the big house, which was the headquarters. And there were the odd bits, and we had a funny little sort of empty office, which was, I think, the stables or something. But it was all small and friendly, and it was a really nice place to be. The first job I had at Bristol was driving the medical office site. It was a little Hillman van, and he used to go around all the flight headquarters every morning to attend to anybody who was on sick parade, and it was a very good way of learning all the various sites in Bristol. He was a very nice chap, and we used to go around, and occasionally you would have an inspection in the afternoon, so you have to go around again and inspect the drains or something. And once or twice I had to take the duty officer around at night, and the only thing to do was to toot the horn to warn the people in the balloon sites that I was coming, or they were coming. But I don't think anybody really realises what a jolly tough job it was being a balloon operator, because most of them at that time were girls, and trying to get those huge balloons up or down in a gale was really very hard work. It was very isolated places, and it was, I should think, the hardest job of all in the whole of the Air Force, really. Never was given much credit.
So they would go up when enemy aircraft...
Yes, well, as soon as whoever was in charge of it heard the aircraft were coming, the balloon people used to be notified, and the balloons would all go up sort of to various heights. In actual fact, I mean, there's no doubt they prevented dive bombing on place. They didn't prevent bombing, but they did prevent dive bombing and machine gunning of civilians. And Bristol had a tremendous battering in 1940, and it did save a tremendous lot of sort of civilian casualties, because you can't stop a bomber dropping bombs from 20,000 feet. But
were you involved in fire watching at that stage?
Yes, we used to have to do our turn of fire watching, which was because we didn't have an awful lot of night duty on that station, because there wasn't night stuff unless there was an emergency and we had to take the duty officer out or something. But yes, we had to do fire watching and rush out with stirrup pumps and tin hats on, which was very uncomfortable if you had curlers in. And it was, I mean, you could see the fires if they bombed Cardiff, you could see them across the Bristol Channel being bombed, you know.
What was the procedure when sirens went off?
Well, if you were sort of not on duty, you leapt out of bed, put on your gas mask, I mean, put the pack on, you put the actual gas mask on, and put on your tin hat and rushed about. If you were on fire duty, you did all your stirrup pumping. And otherwise, you just sort of hung around, really. If you were on duty in the MT, you had to go up to the MT office and be prepared to drive somebody or the doctor or something around. But it wasn't like on a station where you had a definite job, where you didn't actually have a definite job to do, except to get out of the way of the bombs, I think.
Did you have a cinema?
No, we didn't have any. It wasn't really a camp, and we didn't have a naffy or anything like that. We used to make our own coffee in the MT thing. But we had a cinema in the town. We had very good cinema. We had concert halls, and we used to go to a lot of. Mind you, it was very cheap, because we used to get in very cheap if we were in uniform. But we didn't have actually anything on the camp except the functional stuff, like the dining hall and the kitchens and the. I think the dentist had a room there too.
At that stage, did you hear from your parents very much?
Yes, I used to hear probably. I mean, they probably wondered what had happened to me, but. I used to hear from them probably about every 3 weeks or so. I remember there was one panic once, because my letters inevitably were censored, going out more than theirs coming in. And I'd written out, I think, obviously from somewhere, and apparently I heard later that there'd been a terrible stew because my letter had arrived in a porter from Gibraltar. So my parents thought I was in Gibraltar. What was I doing in Gibraltar? In fact, I was sitting in Bristol, but I suppose the post went by Gibraltar. But it amazingly regular, considering everything, I think, that the letters did get through. I mean, quite often, I mean, I couldn't tell them always where I was. I could just give them a sort of BFPS.